The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
Molly, when did you... Whatever brought you back?
Mother, how could you think? As if I could ever live anywhere else but with you.
Oh, well, I thought you'd like it for a while. No, really, you always seem to have such a good time with your father.
Yes, but good times, oh, they aren't what make you belong. It's other kind of times. It's when you've cried together and when you've been through things together. Oh, that's when you seem to love the most.
Hey everyone, it's another Loose Cannons podcast coming at you. I can't believe it myself. But here it is. We haven't been outlawed yet, but I'm sure it's coming. Today we're going to be discussing a movie called Stella Dallas, directed by King Vidor. I forgot to look up the year, sorry.
Before we started. 37, I think.
A very sad movie on a very sad day.
1937's Stella Dallas, directed by King Vidor. But before we do that, let's do this little segment we like to call Heralds and Announcements. Boop, ba da boo. Big old emphasis on the sad trombone noise. Patrick?
I haven't really watched anything lately, so I have nothing to herald or denounce.
Would you like to denounce the election results?
Yeah, I'd like to denounce America. You can all go
just
fuck
white
yourselves.
Just white
fuck
people.
Fuck America. Fuck this country.
Yeah. I would like to denounce non-universal voting, non-ranked voting, voter
suppression,
and disenfranchising white swaths of people to get this exact result, which the Republicans, I believe, don't even want. So,
I mean, they're happy with the House and Senate.
Yeah.
Is the little terrifying bit of schadenfreude I take in this is that the elite Republicans who helped formulate this conclusion hate it. The rural poor who helped foster it are not going to benefit. Yeah. So there's a little bit of sad schadenfreude in that.
Schadenfreude,
of course,
yeah.
You know, mostly rich people voted for Trump. More poor people voted for Clinton than.
As of last count, more people voted for Clinton, so this is even more like Gore versus George W. than we initially realized.
Yeah.
Not as big a difference as Gore.
Yeah.
W. I believe he won like more than a million or more votes than Bush did.
Right.
Yeah, and of course those rich white people will benefit by taking advantage of the poor.
Yep.
Continue to take advantage of the poor.
Yeah, they know what they're doing.
So.
I know where I'm going. Favorite Michael Powell movie.
To Germany. That's where you're going. The last refuge. Oh well.
Yeah. I'll go ahead and Harold Meeks Cutoff is playing on 35mm at my old work. So I went and watched it, and I love that movie. It's a lot of fun in a really sad way, but it's the kind of movie that I feel like loses a lot when you watch it on the small screen, which is how I initially saw it. I still liked it a lot. It was still my favorite Kelly Reichardt movie then, but there's something about the sort of, like, you know, the big screen giving this sort of, like, small-scale story kind of like a huge impact. Like, a lot of the movie is just people walking places, or like a long shot of someone washing a bowl or, like, knitting, and it's just a lot of people just doing things, but there's something about the way that Kelly Reichardt paces it and shoots it that I was like, even if this movie had no plot, I would love this movie. I would just love watching a bunch of frontier people, like, doing what they do every day. And so the fact that it does actually also have sort of a commentary built into it of the ways in which just, like, failure to give other people humanity has kind of created a sort of dissonance, a rift that'll never be recovered, or at least isn't any closer to being recovered than it was, you know, 200 years ago. It's pretty sad. It's a pretty cool movie.
Yep. Yeah. I watched a bit of stuff that I hated and loved. So,
same time.
Yeah. No, I did not really feel that ambiguous about anything. I guess the most recent thing would be To Be or Not to Be, which I rewatched, which I loved, which, I mean, we talked about a lot on this podcast, but still bears repeating. One of the best movies about resistance to a dictatorship ever. made during a dictatorship also. Movie that is, like, manages to be smart beyond its years and still as relevant today as ever. Jumping around between taking itself not seriously at all and then suddenly veering into a territory where you're really not sure what sort of genre this movie has become, and then veering right back and not missing a beat. I think that that's great. I think that that's a special sort of skill to make movies like that. So yeah, it's already on our canon, so I'm just repeating myself at this point, but it's pretty damn great.
Yep. You're flogging that beautiful golden horse.
Yeah.
I haven't watched a movie until I watched this movie directly before this podcast for months. No? I sort of rewatched 22 Jump Street and Premium Rush last month at some point when I was waiting for my brother to pick me up. And then when I got home and the internet was still out, I rewatched a bunch of TV shows, and it's kind of shocking to me that shows that I used to really like, I wouldn't say they're completely without merit, but Community and 30 Rock, like, how I just never noticed the low-level white noise of just awfulness in both of them, and how Tina Fey, who's someone who I definitely would have looked up to in, like, 2008, like, as recently as 2008, is someone who I kind of abhor at this point.
Yep.
On the flip side, Happy Endings is still pretty good, and so is Cougar Town.
That's good.
Yeah, yeah. Peep Show, also still good.
Still the best.
Yeah.
That one I can kind of assume. Yeah. And I've rewatched that one way more recently, like 2 years ago, as opposed to 30 Rock, which had probably been like 5 or 6 years since I had watched any of the episodes besides the last season and a half or whatever.
Right. Yeah, it's probably about how long it's been since I watched the show. 5 years or something like that. Moving in.
All right, moving on to Stella Dallas. This was my pick. So the plot is as such. A young woman named Stella, played by Barbara Stanwyck, is from a very working class family, and she sort of falls in love with an upper class man who's, I guess, involved in the management at the factory where her brother works as a low-level worker, and pursues him and eventually convinces him. They eventually decide to get married and have a child, but very soon after they have a child, the differences in their class and upbringing begin to cause tension between them, eventually leading to him sort of taking a job someplace else and then essentially leading separate lives, where she raises their daughter, who at a certain point she realizes embarrassed of her and maybe would have a better life if she didn't have to deal with her low-class, scare quotes, mother anymore. And so tells the dad and his new wife to basically take her on, and then lies to her daughter in order to drive her away when she tries to come back to her mom. Patrick, what did you think of this movie?
I didn't really like this movie. I thought that I don't really understand like what it was trying to say about that. I guess it just seemed more, it was like it was kind of a tragedy, but I don't know, I didn't really get into the whole story as much as I might have. I don't know, it just seemed like it kept trying to draw me in emotionally, and I didn't ever really connect with the characters. But yeah, I guess a lot of the things that also, I guess the movie was trying to show as being kind of like, I don't know, like low class or tacky or whatever, I actually thought it looked kind of fun. So I don't know, maybe I'm on the Barbara Stanwyck end of the, maybe I'm just like, no, that looks like fun. Like what she wants to do looks like a lot of fun, and what the other people are doing looks like really boring. So I don't know. Maybe that's the point, but I just never really connected with it enough to care that much about the characters.
I like this movie a lot, obviously. I put it on my last canon, the last time we could pick a bunch of movies. Or maybe I didn't put it on the actual list, but it was an honorable mention. I can't remember now.
Yeah, it was an alternate.
Yeah.
If you're talking about the, not, you didn't put it on the canon about influential moments, right? It
was no, the one before that was like the best stuff we'd seen.
Yeah, it was an alternate because yeah. I wanted to see what you thought of it when I finished the movie, and it wasn't on there.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, I like this movie a lot. But part of the reason why I think I like it a lot is that it is sort of a case in point for me of how sometimes one performance can make me like a movie in spite of everything that the movie is about. And I like Barbara Stanwyck in it so much, and I feel like she brings such a like emotional resonance for me with her performance that I do feel all the feelings that she's feeling, even though I think the ideological subtext of the movie is basically that, like, you can't take the poor out of the poor person. No matter how much money you give them, they're still not going to know how to behave like a properly rich person. And obviously, that's pretty gross.
Yeah, I really love Barbara Stanwyck in this, as I expected. And I think because of that, some of the movie's moments worked really, really well for me. I also thought that the movie was pretty firmly on her side because none of the other characters are really very developed and compared to her, at least, not even close. And so whenever the scenes came when she was being embarrassed or someone was feeling embarrassed for her, and I mean, this is probably just by virtue of just liking her acting a lot, I felt that the movie was siding with her. And, you know, I thought that that was actually, if that's the case, pretty radical that it did that, because if you kind of like take it to be like a Douglas Sirky in melodrama, then there's quite a bit of mean things this movie is saying about most of society. But even if you don't, and I think it's fair to not take it like that, I think that her performance is pretty undeniably great. And just for that, the movie gets a thumbs up from me.
I thought this movie was fine. I don't think I was as impressed with the Barbara Stanwyck's performance as you. There are a couple times when there are tense close-ups of her face being, like, super sad, and I was like, okay, pull it back a little. Like, it's gone past the point of me being able to empathize with this character to where I feel ashamed looking at this frame on a screen in a certain way. In fact, I would say that I slightly prefer the performance of her daughter, which I thought was very nice, especially in a couple of the last scenes. But sort of like when I watched a bunch of Joseph von Sternberg films, I don't know if I want to give King Vidor or any of the other filmmakers involved in the production of this film credit, but there's a certain way in which Stella's embarrassing friend, Nunn, I believe is his last name. Ed Nunn, is portrayed that is very gross and telling in a way that I thought was ahead of its time, if even unintentionally, in a way that I appreciated. Again, speaking of relevance, there's a scene where a lecherous drunk who made his money off being a swindler chases around a young woman as a joke, and she runs screaming from the room as an older woman tries to pretend like it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
And man, pretty painful scene to watch.
Yeah.
For in any context, much less the context of today. So I like that, but nothing particularly stood out to me about the cinematography, and I didn't think the performance, there was anything that about the performances that were so exceptional that it could bring it beyond, you know, sort of what I felt like it lacked in aesthetics, personally.
There. Yeah, I mean, well, to kind of build on what Ilya is saying, I think that the movie maybe somewhat intentionally allows for multiple readings. I mean, there's a part early on when Barbara Stanwyck and her soon-to-be husband are at the movies, and she talks about how much she'd love to be like a posh, rich person, like in the movies, and well-behaved, and pretty cool, and like he's like, no, be yourself, you're a fun person, that's why I like you, everyone I know is dull, and then as soon as they're married, he's like, stop being so fun. It's pretty terrible. I want you to just be my wife now, please. And so there is that element of the movie, but then I think that, again, like the ways in which it keeps suggesting that, like, she has basically done the right thing. She's been a great mother by allowing her daughter to, like, flourish in this alternate world, the world that she was born for, is, like, it's definitely, like, both readings are there, but I think that ultimately, at least, like, given when the movie was made, you kind of have to go with the idea that Kingdom Fedor wasn't some radical feminist. And, you know, like, probably thought, yeah, you know, it's sad that she has to do this, but this is the right thing to do.
Yeah,
her daughter.
At the very least, yeah. We can say he wasn't an intersectional feminist because of his presentation of black women in this
yeah.
movie.
Yeah, oh, sure. I actually was wanted yeah. to say about that. Like, to me, like, there's a lot of scenes in which, like, Stella herself is not a character that garners a lot of sympathy for a lot of things. I mean, like, she, the way she treats people that are, in her mind, like, beneath her, is pretty telling and is pretty disgusting. And Stanwyck plays that, like, pretty well, in the sense of, like, she doesn't make you want to like her still, you know, while being that way. You know, she's not like, well, she's really nice to the maid. No, she's not. Like, never. Like, not at all. She talks to her and then she fires her. And then, like, you know, she keeps yelling at her all the time. Not saying that the movie was even in any way aware of this, but, like, watching it now, the way that Stanwyck performs it makes me, like, feel like, okay, this is a very problematic person who also thinks that being rich is a virtue unto its own, and that will do anything to make sure that her daughter gets that which she didn't get, or which she failed to completely get. And, like, for some reason thinks that that will make her a good mother. And I think that that's sort of a brainwash of her being, like, a representative of the lower class who buys into that, and a society who believes that that is really truly the case, and that because you have more, you really deserve it. You know, that's, like, you could say, like, the kind of reading that is definitely not intention in the movie, but I feel like is not too far-fetched just looking at how, you know, her whole life in this movie is basically based on that. Like, she's so sucked into that ideology that that's, to me, like, the real sadness of it, that, you know.
Yeah,
this, I mean, even... the movie isn't that far from Madame Bovary. Like, it's kind of like Madame Bovary that maybe rich people could more tolerate in a way, because it's not so obviously a painful critique of that sort of romantic longing. And yeah, like, I think building off that, you could say, like, the most positive interpretation, most hopeful interpretation you could give to the movie is that it starts off with this shot of workers leaving a factory to, like, upbeat music and, like, a whistle blowing, and seems like kind of a nice world. And there's Stella Dallas standing, well, her name's not Dallas at that point, standing at this white picket fence, pretending to read a love poems book, and there's something sort of idyllic about everything that's happening. And then the movie ends with her being shuffled off by a policeman for staring at rich people, being like, no, you can't do this.
Yeah.
And, like, that sort of stratification of society, like, how, like, yeah, there's one way to read it in which, like, poor people can never be rich or something like that. Like, they can't get these manners that have been lost to them. And there's another way you can read it, where wanting to be rich ruins perfectly decent people from having any sort of life or happiness.
Yeah. Yeah, because I was going to say that ending, like, I don't know, it seems kind of sad, but also, like, the music is kind of swelling, and she is feeling kind of like she accomplished her goal by getting her daughter to the place where she could marry a rich person. Yeah, it was also,
it's
like,
definitely, like, a noble sacrifice.
Where it also seems, like, kind of horrible to me also, because that guy was, like, in with that group of people who was just making fun of her, too. So, like, she's just basically just like, here, you know, marry into this clique of people who hates me, basically. Like, I'll shunt myself off to the side. Yeah, I guess that's what
I missed my shot at fitting in, but you don't have to, daughter.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. I guess I just didn't, like, that was part of why I was looking at the movie as, like, yeah, I don't really agree with what this movie is saying about, you know, what is good. Although I guess I was assuming that she was feeling like, you know, she had won at that point at the end of the movie because she's smiling at the end, but I didn't feel like the movie was going far enough in the other direction where it was, like, actually saying, like, no, this is a terrible thing that's happened. Yeah, it was kind of like, well, now she can go and live her life in that, you know, fun pauperish way or whatever, and I was like, it's kind of terrible.
I was saying it's a generous reading. I wasn't saying that it's the only reading or the most accurate one.
Yeah.
But I think that part of what's cool about the movie that I do sort of like is that there are sort of like ways in which a contemporary audience can like make the movie theirs. Like, that, you know, you don't have to care what King Vidor actually thought. And that I think that, you know, for me at least, the bigness of Barbara Stanwyck's performance does sort of invite that for me, where it's like, oh, maybe the movie actually, you know, maybe like she's playing it as if she doesn't really agree with, you know, this movie's reading, because she is such a, like, a human person that I care about, and she is pretty fun. It is pretty funny when they make all those rich people itch themselves on the train, and, like, it is, you know, like, going to a party and dancing sounds way more fun than going to a party and just sitting around talking to a bunch of stuffy white people. Like, there's a lot of ways in which, like, you know, society in general has sort of shifted from when this movie was made to now, that you can just be like, yeah, I'm with Stanwyck. Like, fuck those manners. I don't need to be like that. Like, even if I have money, I can just enjoy it instead of walking around being... I mean, the woman that the husband eventually ends up marrying, she's really boring. She's nice, but super boring. Like, if there was a world in which I was like, these are my two sort of romantic options, I'm picking Stanwyck every time, for sure.
Plus, there's, like, no reason given why her daughter even likes that woman, except that she's rich.
She's like a gray flower that won't wilt in the winter.
Exactly, yeah.
what a wonderful, sad description of her. It's, like, totally dull but won't die.
Yeah.
Yep, just steadfast, and it's calm plainness.
I was going to say, I feel like I don't want to even give this movie too much of disservice, because I feel like there's some parts where I don't feel like there is any other interpretation. Like, they've just had the baby, she's come home, she's been trying through pregnancy for a long time, and she says, everyone knows better what to do about maternity except for the mother, the doctors, the men, the father. They all think they know what's going on. You would think that my experience would win me, you know, some sort of power in terms of, you know, discussing what happens here. And I don't feel like the movie at all is critiquing Stanwyck for having that opinion. And that would be considered kind of radical for the time in a way, mm-hmm. for a woman to be like, I should be the boss of my childbearing. It's still yeah. kind of radical now. And I don't feel like there's any sort of argument to say that it's critiquing her in that moment.
No.
No, I don't think so.
I agree with that. And I mean, there's, like, you know, ways in which she shifts, like, throughout the course of the movie to be kind of the perfect mother. Like, she's, like, at least within the eyes of the movie, like, that regardless of her other flaws, she's almost always a really good mother. Like, even when they're, like, goofing around, when the baby's a baby, she's like, oh, I don't even like going out anymore. I just spend all my time with Laurel. Like, she's a real pal to me. And then, you know, like, they make a point of pointing out that she's just drinking sarsaparilla. She doesn't even drink anymore, and she never drinks for the rest of the movie. So, like, becoming a mother really shifted her desires and sort of, like, put them down onto her. And the movie, like, really looks up to her for that, which I've read a lot about this era, and that those were the exact kind of demographic that the movie was trying to appeal to. A lot of female viewers went to movies like this, and then they were like, oh, she's such a great mother. Yeah. It's like me. I'm a great mother.
Yeah, and I feel like, right, but this, like, I don't necessarily, I don't even want to put forth the idea that I think sometimes people think that, like, suffering is the right choice. Like, if you're not suffering, you're not doing the right thing. But right. the dad makes no sacrifices. Like, it's yeah. not like, like, I feel like there's definitely a middle ground between, you know, Sophie's choice and absent yeah. father figure. But he definitely doesn't come off clean to me in this movie.
No.
Like, he gets jealous of this dude, which, okay, whatever, understandable. And then he's like, I'm leaving, come with me. And when she's like, no, he's like, all right, fine, take care of our daughter. I'll see you in 10 years.
Then he shows up unannounced at her house for Christmas.
And he's like,
hey, yeah, got these tickets. They're in an
he's
hour.
Like, everything's fine now that I'm over it. Oh, this right. guy, you threw him out. You obviously didn't want him around, but he came back. That's too much for me to handle.
I want her now for the holidays. I want her. Don't I get to have her?
I would say that, yeah,
fuck that guy.
I would say that I feel like this movie's how it sees women having more agency, it's particularly flawed, but perhaps its critique of men is not as flawed as
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
There's some truth hanging around in the way that this movie presents men.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I brought it up so early, this scene early on, why it's one of my faves, that, you know, I mean, it is very pointed the way it juxtaposes him being like, no, I like you for who you are, with, like, almost the very next scene, him being like, could you stop being who you are and just
yeah.
be more like me?
I mean, there's something amazing about a movie that basically says, okay, so women want to be rich. They want that money, right? They got to get that money. They marry someone, even though it's not for love. It's for money, because, like, that's their prerogative. Then they discover that actually they got their priorities all mixed up. Their priorities should be on having a kid and then putting all their energy right up on that kid. And that's all they care about from then on. It's just kids. That's everything is about the kid from that. She forgets herself. She forgets all of that, her own ambition and her own plans, and gives up everything for the kid. And then she gives up the kid, because obviously that's also wrong. And then she can finally go and become a nun or something, right? Like, then she's like, oh, now I'm pure. I'm purified by my own self-sacrifice. Like, there's something really, like, fascinatingly fucked up about that whole trail of thought that was so prevalent then and is still fucking prevalent now. But, I mean, in that sense, this movie lays it on real thick, but lays it out pretty well, I think, you know? Those melodramas, they somehow always get some things really right.
there's a little bit of truth-telling in there.
Mm. Because if you think about it, this is just how men see women. Melodramas have, like, always been about that, right? This is just men making things about how they think women should see themselves, you know? And it's just so gross. It's just, and when it's well made, it's that much more terrifying, you know?
Yeah.
And when it has these performances like Barbara Stanwyck has in this movie, it feels like the movie's like within itself, there's like a resistance going on to this like vision that's put onto it. But I mean, she can only do so much, right? She's still trapped in the fucking movie.
Yeah.
Right.
But,
I will say this about Stanwyck's performance, which, I mean, again, I liked. I just didn't. I am not as crazy about it as y'all are. Is that no one has ever said the words "nuh-uh" as well as Barbara Stanwyck does. Every time she says it in any movie that I see her in, where she goes "nuh-uh," it's like through me. It's amazing.
She always makes a great face when she does it too. Like she has that like magical like "nuh-uh." Like added something about the way that she opens her mouth. Like she kind of like. It's like a crooked mouth opening thing. I don't know.
I know this. I mean, in general, again, just talking more about feminism and stuff, you know, there's not a long history of women saying no, and certainly not a long history of women saying no and actually having the person they said no to listen to them. Mm-hmm. It's pretty rare for those two things to intercede. And so every time she's given the chance to say no, in one of these movies, she delivers it both offhandedly in a way that makes it seem like it's normal and that there's this immense power that she doesn't even have to really consider it, which is like pretty amazing. Like it's why every time I see her in a movie, I'm so taken by one of her characters. It's like this place that I think a lot of people would like women to be in, she's able to inhabit even for that moment, just like it actually existing.
It's true.
That's a lot to read into.
Yep.
One word, but
that's how good she is.
She's a very impressive actress in a lot of ways.
I think this movie would make a good double bill with Bad Moms.
I don't know. Yeah. I thought that actually right in the beginning, like the thing that really always strikes me about her acting is like there's always something that she does that no other actor in the same movie will ever do. Like she's standing there, she's looking outside like at the, you know, at the people passing by. She's standing in the garden and she like starts like rubbing her finger on this like on the fence in this weird way that's like definitely not the director's intention, it feels like. It's just like, I'm just going to do this now that has nothing to do with what I'm about to say, but I'm going to, like, own this scene somehow. Like, her physicality in scenes is always incredible. She always makes things... I mean, her voice, I've talked about it, like, is by far her most powerful, like, weapon when she's acting, because she can have a way of making things feel emotionally resonant when they have no reason to be, and when the script is hackneyed, and when the framing of the shot makes you kind of cringe at the moment, she can still like make things seem, I don't know, much more like felt than they otherwise would be. And The other thing that she does is that she, you know, she sometimes sits in a weird way, or she would like cock her head to the side when she's talking, and or just like the way she walks, like sometimes it's just all a bit off in a way that no other actor in the same movie that she's in is able to do, because like it seems like she just like decides that this is the right way, and then no one can tell her no. And I feel like that sort of a power that an actor can convey can be very cool, because it can feel like she's, you know, she's moving by her own set of rules. And I think that that's always, I don't know, something really cool about her.
And I think it's probably part of the reason why she was always cast in these kind of roles, but she's amazing at creating a sense of engendering audience sympathy while she's being sort of like a grifter. She's just like she shows up with that box and she's like so coy about like, oh, I was trying to bring my brother lunch. Would you help me find him, please? And she's and he's like giving these complicated instructions, and she's like, and like playing it like she just doesn't understand completely, so that he'll do exactly what she wants, which is, you know, try and call the brother. The brother's not there because she showed up late on purpose, obviously. So then she can give the rich guy the sandwich and impress him with her fancy sandwich making skills. And, but
which like isn't like, that in that scene, like, isn't it so funny when like both guys are like, did you make this yourself? And she clearly has like a delicatessen box that she unpacks, but I'm like, you motherfuckers have never seen a sandwich before, you've never gone to the store yourselves. So you think that this is what homemade cooking looks like. It comes in a right. In a box with a sign on it, right? Like, that's how it's usually done.
A wrapper.
God.
But it's, yeah.
Yeah, whenever I think about the really tired and bad joke about going into the kitchen and making me a sandwich, it just makes me so frustrated and sad for that group of people that they don't realize what a self-owned that is, that you can't make your own sandwich, perhaps the easiest meal in the entire world. But like, you can't make a good sandwich? Like, how do you even take a shit? Like, what? do you need someone to wipe your ass for you? Like, how incapable are you at life?
Relax your butthole, like, for you?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's like,
You've failed to put protein on bread.
It's like, yeah. The only people who can't make a sandwich are the people who physically lack the ability to make sandwiches. Yeah. Like, who can't use their arms. Like,
plenty of those people can still make a sandwich.
They find ways. Yeah.
They find, yeah. They could, yeah. It's probably not that hard. You just gotta, like, drag. Like, wasn't it, What movie was that where she, there was a, it was Abuse of Weakness, where she's making the sandwich and she's gotta like, she's like falling over, like she hurts
she
herself.
Won't stop.
The
she won't stop
yeah,
making like, her meal until she just like,
she's still
can't
making
do it
that
at
sandwich. Yeah.
It's the difference between a man and a woman.
Yeah.
Even the slightest inconvenience is too much for him to make a sandwich, whereas she's like literally having a stroke and still trying to eat her dinner.
Yeah. Sorry.
Also,
yeah, I interrupted you,
this
Basil.
This is only tangentially related, but what a denial of self-pleasure. Making a great sandwich for yourself is extremely satisfying. Like, I feel like these men should read more Blondie comics. Like, look at Dagwood. He can't wait to make himself a sandwich every single day.
I want a giant sandwich.
Yes, anding that, the great irony of how much all these people want to argue that, you know, the government shouldn't give you benefits because the work that you do will bring you more pleasure, and yet aren't willing to do a single thing in their own homes.
Right.
Like, you fucking choke on that irony. Maybe that's why you all hate your marriages.
Right.
Because you've never even put a second of work into your domestic
life.
There's
also something funny about how this movie, like, her husband, right, who's supposedly working all this time, you never see him actually work the whole time he's in the movie. He never does anything.
His job is leaving his family. That's what I assume.
And he excels at that. And then
his job is wearing a suit.
And apparently, like,
he just has to go to an office and sit somewhere where his family isn't and just sit there. That's his job.
He's got to grease his hair every morning. Let's not forget about that.
Yeah,
it's true.
It's the difference between him and the poor person and the new rich person is he has greased hair.
Yeah, whereas you see Barbara, you see Stella in this movie constantly making stuff. Like, she's setting the table, she's making her daughter dresses, she's, like, feeding people, she's, like, entertaining people in this way or that way. She's always doing something. That guy is just there, and he's, like, the most boring person imaginable. He does nothing. He says nothing really interesting. And yet he, like, demands things for himself for the only reason that he has wealth. And, like, again, not that the movie explicitly thinks that this is a comment on something. Like, I'm not sure King Vidor is making a comment, but it's very, very telling that his normal idea of what a guy should be like, quote-unquote normal guy should be like in a movie, is that, you know, which is nothing. You know, like, such a big fat nothing.
Yeah, and I wanted to say, just to put it out there, that this is not a class-based critique of men. So, like, if we go through the men in the movie, the first interaction we really see with Stella is with her brother, who first teases her about having a romantic interest, and then when he gets teased back, threatens to abandon his mother and sister, who have no way of making income because he can afford a house on his own, as either a serious threat or a joking threat. Either way is not okay. and Stella, like, the mother's like, oh no, don't do that, don't tease him, because, you know, she's obviously thinking about being out on the street.
Right.
And Stella's like, he deserves it. And and you should be aware of that. And then, you know, of course, then we move to all the issues that we've already discussed with her husband. And then, you know, and then we get the new money person, who probably is the worst of all three of them, with the none of the faux politeness of the rich, and yet still all the power of the rich have as well. So just, like, a crudeness combined with agency.
All right.
Yeah.
But he gets his own ruin.
And entitlement that is not hidden. Like, entitlement that is, like, being called out by himself, called for by him. Like, he wants everybody to know how entitled he is.
That's why the old rich don't like the new rich, is because they make it so obvious how much, like, rich people hate poor people.
Shush, guys. Come on. It's no, like, one's supposed to notice. Game. Yeah. I don't know.
Why do you think Marie Antoinette is the scapegoat for 100 years of French monarchy destroying the country? She didn't know the rules.
Yeah, that's your problem. This basically teenage person who's never had this much power before in her life, that's your fucking scapegoat right there, right? Not the hundreds of years of monarchy before her.
I think the French Revolution was caused by the French not letting her take her pug across the state lines.
Yep.
That was it. She would have been a much better queen.
That's it. Yeah. She'd have had her dog.
The sexism of the French Revolution. An interesting potential essay.
Yeah. So, yeah, now that Basil has sort of said what is really appealing to him about this movie, if he didn't before, I assume he now really understands how I, and I believe Ilya, still feel about Blonde Venus.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty much the same.
Yeah, that's why.
Argument. And I would say that probably the reason why I, you know, feel that way about Blonde Venus and not as much about this is because Blonde Venus is just a much better looking movie.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely is. That's
Von Sternberg's just
no question. Yeah,
a ridiculous composer of shots.
Yeah, and
now I understand why I don't like both of them.
Yeah,
although I definitely have some movies that I like, despite themselves.
Do you like melodrama, Patrick?
You like Buffy?
Women suffering. Yeah. So much.
Generally, you like Buffy, right?
Yeah, but I generally find the more melodrama-y parts of Buffy to be the least appealing, I guess. So I guess maybe I don't.
Except you like Die Hard.
I do like Die Hard. Die Hard's problematic. That's, I guess.
Melodrama.
No.
Melodrama.
Yeah, nice. I only brought that up because Mitchell took a like 80s melodrama class, and the teacher thought he had a real hot take when he showed Die Hard to the class. He's like, isn't this kind of a melodrama when you break down the structure?
That's funny. Yeah. That's a good point.
A lot of action movies are about belief by men, like how they're going to retake their masculine role in a society that's crumbling around them.
Yeah.
I guess that's my weakness then, probably.
You like action your melodramas more like male-y.
Like my melodramas with guns.
I would say that would be one of my critiques of this movie. Not enough guns. There definitely should have been a shootout between Stella and the new wife over the daughter.
Stella doesn't blow up the roof of a building in this one.
It would have been funny if Stella just, like, once they're in the train and these girls start, like, talking all this shit about her, would have just, like, run out and shot them in the face. And then, like, her daughter would just
hilarious.
climb inside her bed and be like, Mommy, I love you so much. The end.
I mean, that's essentially what Serial Mom is, right? It's like a parody of this kind of melodrama where the mom will do anything for her children. So she's like, oh, you gave my son a bad grade. Now I'm going to run you over with my car. That makes me like that movie a little bit more. Recognizing that commentary, making fun of those movies where a mom will literally do anything for their children.
Serial.
I guess that's a good stopping.
I think so.
Since we're all just quiet for a little bit. I mean, I don't have a whole lot more to say. I'm sure I could talk about specific scenes if we wanted to, but it's a somber day.
Yeah, we are recording this on November 9th, just in case people
hadn't picked that up.
Yeah. I feel like there's a good chance that this, and maybe not quite this level of somber tone, but will be continuing for some time.
Maybe it will actually be increasing in somberness, like as the years go on.
Yeah, our choices will start to reflect it too.
Yeah,
we'll just be like Satan Tango.
We'll just be watching
The Human Condition,
or just watching like
The Death of Mr. Lazarescu,
mind numbing torture porn, and just like thinking that this accurately reflects our state of mind at the moment.
Cannibal Holocaust today.
Yep. You think there's any way that the remaining 2 months of the Obama presidency can push through the appointment of Supreme Court Justice Merrick?
I doubt it.
Yeah.
The Republicans control everything at this point.
Well, but those people don't start till the beginning of the year either. But
yeah. They're just going to be like, no, meh. They see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, they do. Jesus. Well, the, sort of.
The blinding bright white of the tunnel. Yeah. Well, as you said, the blinding bright white.
Rubbing their hands on coal dust.
Of the nuclear shockwave heading our way.
Man. Now I've just got my fingers crossed that, like, his troll was the ultimate troll, and then he's just gonna, once he gets into office, be like, boom. Turns out I'm a progressive, dudes. Free healthcare. Free schooling. Boom, boom, boom.
Oh my god.
Yep.
Did you see any of his acceptance
speech? I don't think he's in anything.
Mm. He's into himself. Yeah. Like, he's in this for making money for himself. That's it.
I think he's like a sponge. He takes on the flavor of whatever he's near. Yeah. And right now he's near Rudy Giuliani and Mike Pence.
Yeah. I'm actually even more concerned with the sort of cabinet he's going to appoint than just him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. Rudy Giuliani, yeah. Secretary of State. I mean, like, aren't we all looking forward to that?
He has no experience, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was some, like.
Alex Jones, like, Minister of Interior. Fuck yeah.
Slightly hopeful, excited talk about, like, you know, how Trump's complete inability to avoid controversy might lead to him getting impeached. And I'm like, yeah, then we've got President Pence, who would be worse and might actually get reelected, unlike Trump, who has almost no chance of getting reelected.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool beans. Good way to end this podcast with our own suffering.
That's why this movie was so very apropos. Like I told Basil. Like,
what? What just can we sacrifice sadness. To make the world better for our children? Doesn't look like we have a route to that.
That's true.
I'd be happy to give it up, even though I'm not. I don't have children.
Yeah.
If you wanted to just empty my bank account, that'd be fine. I'd do it.
Here's my $100 that I have in my bank account. Good luck with that.
Oh, man.
I'm just kidding. I have less than $100.
Shit.
Me too.
Shit.
But on the plus side, my girlfriend and I are going to do mushrooms on Monday.
Exciting.
Fun.
I get this feeling
drugs are all we have to look forward to.
Drugs are going
to
be a much bigger part of my life than ever before.
Yeah, California legalized marijuana, so.
They did?
I guess I can. Yeah. Oh,
sweet. Yeah. Nice. Good for them. So, I guess, marijuana, but that's still good. It's a start to legalizing more and better drugs.
Anyway, it's just like, whatever.
But, yeah.
Better drugs.
Legalize better drugs.
Yeah, I can't wait to buy heroin in a dispensary. When's that going to happen?
Just go to Sweden. You don't buy it at a dispensary. You have to get it at a hospital, and it's given to you by a doctor. But
It's a cool program.
It reminds me of a skit I did where it was like a character went back in time, and he, like, one of the characters in the skit was a doctor, and then he goes back in time, and the doctor's like, "All right, let's give him a bottle of heroin." They're like, man, medicine was fucked up back in the day.
It's still.
Yeah, it hasn't really gotten better.
A little bit, yeah.
I mean, no, it's different. What's that say? It's gotten a lot better, but at some point during the 90s, they decided to deregulate some of it, and Big Pharma decided the solution to that deregulation was to push opioids on everybody. Yeah. Basically recreating an enormous heroin epidemic that hadn't existed for 100 years. Yeah. So.
Yep. It's back. It's back in full force. I see people from Alabama posting about it all the time.
Sure. Oh, it's and yeah. Because it's a drug epidemic that's affecting mostly white population. It's now a health crisis instead of a crime one.
Right.
A criminal one.
Instead of something we should put prison, we should people in prison for, right?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that worked so well.
If we put them in prison, then they won't be able to vote. Yeah. So it's important to keep them out of prison.
Yeah. Right. In a weird way, this is maybe the way that they're going to, you know, create a healthy system for dealing with drugs in this country, even though it's horrible that it had to be, you know.
It probably won't be accessible to felons, though, so that they can still
probably
keep a certain class of people from that creative way of
well, because who cares about
disenfranchising
felons?
People.
They can't vote anyway, right? So,
so if you want to have some schadenfreude for the other side, you can thank Bill Clinton for massively expanding mass incarceration, because all those people he sent to jail probably would have voted for Hillary and couldn't vote. It's been a real tag team effort by Republicans and Democrats of just destroying poor people in America for years. And that's not really even counting the destruction they've done to poor people across the globe.
Yeah. At least we're consistent. We don't just hate poor people in our own country. We hate them everywhere.
Yeah, well, we got to keep that stratification. So, black people got to vote for Democrats because at least their lives are better than people in the Middle East. And then white people got to vote for Republicans because at least their lives are better than poor black people.
Yeah.
And then the rich people roll around on a pile of money.
Either way. Yeah.
I mean, what's more telling than Hillary Clinton saying, you know, I support what happened, and we should try to move forward as a country.
Easy for her to say.
After, after the electorate who voted against her said that she should be sent to jail and murdered.
Right.
Let's just look beyond that, pretend like it didn't happen.
Come together as a country.
Yay.
That's what his acceptance speech is about, too.
This is why every time someone calls for unity, I'm like, I don't want to be unified with pieces of shit. That's, and people are like, oh, we need to, you know, stand for the Star Spangled Banner or whatever. You know, that's a moment when we put our differences aside so we recognize the importance of unity. So unity has never gotten anything done. Unity got us into World War II. Unity created slavery. These are the actions of unity. The actions of a small, angry minority are the ones who've gotten actual good work done, like the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, I mean, it's not surprising, but I read about a study recently where, like, the same person and a group of people who, like, share mostly their same views have less good ideas than that same person in a group of people who have, who do not necessarily share their views. So, like, just like, it's not even a matter of like a group of people just being uncreative. You're inherently less creative depending about like who is around you. Just not surprising, but still depressing that science like proved it.
Oh.
Maybe that's why a lot of interesting weirdos come from the South. like Ross McElwee.
That's true.
Yeah.
So they, their whole life they've been trying to hide and pivot.
I guess that's also why Armand White's a real interesting weirdo, in spite of how much I disagree with them.
Yeah.
Doesn't get much weirder than
black, gay, Republican,
neocon.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, at least at least we're back. That's
mm-hmm.
That's something to look forward to, people.
Yeah.
See, we're unified. This election brought us back together.
Sure did.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I guess I'll conclude my last thought about this is people putting their hope in Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the like. Just remember that a month ago she said that Colin Kaepernick was stupid, so good luck with that. Those same people also thought that Hillary Clinton was for sure going to win this election, so they're obviously doing the good work that's necessary. They have their pulse on the people, and they know what they want in order to get that electorate moving.
Get them energized.
Thanks for listening to the podcast, everyone. I hope you enjoyed our discussion both of Stella Dallas and the election and our oncoming or current depression. If you are enjoying all of those things, you can always subscribe to us using your podcast listening app. Give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. We really do appreciate it. But for now, we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.